I am no longer a fan. I am a fool. All right. And you start thinking about, am I going to do this again next year? I am not so sure. So that's a problem on Monday. So that Tuesday, Dave Brandon fires his PR guy, his latest PR guy, Pete Scorch. Scorch had been there 1 year from the Detroit Pistons. He had already replaced Dave Abeloff, had already replaced Bruce Mottey. Get this, for 40 years, Michigan had exactly three PR guys who did an amazing job. Will Perry, Bruce Mottey, and Dave Abeloff, three of the very best in the business, all, I will admit, close friends of mine, naturally. They pushed aside Bruce Mottey the first year, pushed aside Dave Abeloff the second year, and you put Pete Scorch in there and you fire him. Three guys for 40 years, and now three guys in 3 years. You have a PR problem already. And for the first time that Saturday, all right, Dave Abeloff had always had the TV feed in his ear at Bruce Mottey's insistence for 19 seasons, 241 straight games. And the reason Bruce told me he did that is because TV drives everything. And even though I'm a print guy and Bob Giles is a print guy, of course, all right, we both know that TV drives everything. If a Michigan coach might be a little short, say, with a sideline reporter during halftime, this has been known to happen, all right, you better know about that when it happens. If someone out there is hot-dogging or whatever else, unsportsmanlike, you better know about that when it happens. If there might be an injury that needs to be explained, you better know about that when it happens. All right, Dave Abeloff has been told that weekend to not be in the press box. He does not have the TV feed, so that's one more safety net that's gone. All right, in Pete Scorch's place, replacement, he hires somebody who's already in the department, doing a very good job as the HR person for development, all right, as well as development for the whole department. She is now put in charge of PR. She's got no experience, no training in journalism, but there she is. I give her credit for volunteering for this, but this is clearly a disaster waiting to happen. On top of that, you've got Paul Schmidt, 30-some year trainer who's one of the best in the business, I can assure you. He's been told that summer for the first time in 30 years, you are no longer allowed to talk to the sideline reporters during games. It's one of the small little side jobs that served a very important purpose to keep the lines of communication open between the press box and TV and the medical staff on the sideline. I've seen Paul do this hundreds of times on the sidelines. He's amazingly good at this. He's also, if you listen carefully, actually quite funny. What happens is this. A Michigan player limps off the field. Brent Musburger says to a sideline reporter, Quint on the sideline, Quint, I see a Michigan player limping up the field. Please tell us what's going on down there. And Quint talks to Paul Schmidt and says, I'm with head trainer Paul Schmidt of the University of Michigan. Mr. Schmidt, what seems to be the case? He says, well, Quint, we think it's his knee and we'll know more after halftime. Which, by the way, you could say about half of us here tonight. That is exactly nothing. All right, you violated nothing. There's no information. There's nothing the other coaches can use. All right, but it does keep the lines of communication open between the medical staff on the sideline and the TV guys in the booth. That might be, who knows, crucial down the road. You've also pushed out John Falk that summer. John Falk had been the 41-year equipment manager for Michigan, hired by Bo, a legend at Michigan, trust me. Second book is out right now, actually. With John Falk goes one of his crucial policies, and it works like this. Wherever the backup quarterback is, one of John's student manager has got one job. Wherever that guy goes, you have his helmet in your hand, and you follow him around like a bad dog. That is your one job. Because the second the starting quarterback is out, that guy's got to run in, and 20-year-old men will, in fact, lose anything, all right, including their helmets. So you hand him the helmet, and he runs out there, and that is one more safeguard Michigan no longer has when, who knows, it just might matter down the road. On top of that, you've got a head coach, Brady Hoke, whom the players truly did love, and that's clearly identified in the book, who's in the habit of not wearing headsets during the game. So if anything happens in the field that he can't see, but the guys in the press box can see, he will not know about it. So I ask you, if you've alienated the former employees, the lettermen, the students, the faculty, the regents, you've fired, pushed aside Bruce Mottey, Dave Abeloff, you've hired Pete Scorch, you've hired somebody with no experience whatsoever, you've told Paul Schmidt he can't talk to the press, you've told John Falk he's gone and so is his policy, and Brady Hoke does not know what's going on in the press box, I ask you, what could possibly go wrong? I'm kind of amazed it took that long, actually. So what goes wrong? You all know what happens next, obviously. The doctors and the trainers sit on the far side of the bench. I've been down there. Some of you might have been on the sidelines at some point or other. And you know, it may be cool to be on the sidelines. It is the worst seat in the house. Because you're sitting behind 120 guys as big as Joe Carriage, and even bigger, of course, than those guys. You can't see really anything. On top of that, this play happens on the far left side of the field. So that's behind the Minnesota defensive line, the Michigan offensive line. Behind all that is Shane Morris, who gets hit pretty badly on a play late in the game. They don't see the hit. That is clearly a blind spot that Michigan's got to fix. Michigan fixes that the next weekend. I've learned this since the book came out, by the way. They have been asking, the medical staff have been asking Dave Brandon for years for a dedicated skybox, for an eye in the sky, for the training staff to be able to recognize things on the field and report them immediately to the guys on the sideline. All right, he was refused due to money. All right, throughout the whole thing. So they don't see the play. They fix the problem the very next weekend by finally getting that skybox. And they had 200 people come in, doctors and trainers from around the country, to explain to all of them in Ann Arbor, here's what happened, here's how it happened, here's how we fixed it, and this is how you should fix it too, the Michigan way. That, to me, is leaders and best. Leaders and best does not mean you're perfect or you're angels or you're never going to screw up. Leaders and best means when you do screw up, you own it, you fix it, and you show other people how to fix it also. One of Don Canham's great phrases, which describes PR in a nutshell, is never turn a one-day story into a two-day story. It is just that simple, but it's also incredibly hard because nobody does it. And I can prove that also, by the way. I'm in journalism, of course, with Bob Giles. If we went to a press conference and a guy gets up there and apologizes, we write it down and then we're incredibly bored and we leave. There's no story there. If, however, you give us a cover-up, those are fascinating. We love those. We start pulling guys of other stories, and we're crawling around your life all of a sudden. Look, the Whitewater land deal ends up with a blue dress in D.C. They're not looking for a blue dress in D.C. That's what you end up with when you got 100 reporters crawling over your life. All right? You don't want that. So that's what the trainers and the doctors did. That's not what Michigan did otherwise in this case. So they missed the play. Shane Morris had banged up his right ankle earlier in the game. They know that. They see him limping a bit. They assume, again, it's his right ankle. They ask him if he wants to come out of the game, and he goes like this. Give me the play. I want to stay. So he gets the play. He runs another play, and by now, the Michigan students who are already ticked off, of course, and by the way, I've never seen happy 20-year-olds become, I've never heard miserable 20-year-olds become happy 50-year-olds. That never happens. And that's a problem for development down the road with that gang right there. So they're already booing, and the next play, Shane Morris comes out. When he comes out, and I've got a lot of witnesses here in the book telling me this, when he comes out, he says, I think I broke my ankle, and he yells it. So everyone assumes it's his ankle. If you're a doctor or trainer who missed the play, you start treating his ankle. And that's what they did. So while that's going on, Devin Gardner, the backup quarterback at this point, goes into the game. Two plays later, his helmet pops off. The new rules are very clear on this. Once the helmet pops off, you got to come off the field without any explanation whatsoever and take at least one play off, or your team can call a timeout and put you back in the field. Brady Hoke knows the rules, but the referee does not. So Brady Hoke is arguing with this guy, I want to call a timeout and put Devin Gardner back in the field. And the referee says, you can call a timeout, but he's not coming back in the field until he sits out one play. One day later, the head of officials at the Big Ten calls Brady Hoke in his office at Michigan to apologize for the fact that Hoke knew the rule and the referee didn't, and what a big help that was a day later. So that's the untold story there. So what happens next? Russell Bellamy was the third-string quarterback. Now he's a second-string quarterback. Devin Gardner comes off the field. Now Russell Bellamy is the starting quarterback at that point. But being a 21-year-old man, he can't find his helmet. You're seeing the train coming now, aren't you? It's going to hit every stop, folks, I promise you. So he's scrambling around. John Falk is gone. The student manager no longer has the policy to carry his helmet around wherever he goes. He's yelling for his helmet, can't find it. He's wearing a headset with a clipboard. Finally, Russell Bellamy turns down the bench and yells at Shane Morris to get in the game. And that is how Shane Morris went back into the game. He heard him, felt okay, ran back into the game. It was not the head coach, not the assistant coaches, not the doctors, not the trainers. It was the third-string quarterback who made that call. That is a chain of command that has broken down miserably at that point. So that's why Shane Morris goes back in the game, and now the boos are a cacophony on the national game of the week, another lucky break for Michigan. And Ed Cunningham of ABC is yelling, this is atrocious. This is atrocious. And that is the ringing phrase that goes on ESPN every half an hour for a day and a half after that. In fact, it got so bad. And by the way, Shane Morris was okay. That night he had dinner with his parents. He felt fine. The PR person who's supposed to see all this missed the play. I can tell you why. Because she was talking to me. Surprise. We're having a friendly little chat in the Regents box over nothing in particular. She's trying to build some more bridges to the media. I respect her for doing that. It's a smart idea. But you missed the play in the process, and Dave Abloff is not there to hear what's going on. So Michigan does not realize it's got a media crisis until Monday morning. In the meantime, this story is running on ESPN, on CNN. It hits Good Morning America. It even gets to Al Jazeera, for crying out loud. And I know this because I was the guy on Al Jazeera, for crying out loud. Talking to David Schuster, a friend of mine from Michigan, who's one of their anchors there. And I'm on a half an hour segment following stories on ISIS, Ebola, and Michigan football. You have a PR problem. We can all agree on that. So Monday morning, Michigan finally figures that out a day and a half later. They've got a PR problem. They start meeting 8 o'clock in the morning at the Champions Center, the Champions Room, the big glass room in the athletic department on the first floor. About 15 people are going in and out of this meeting the entire day, but not, crucially, the coaches, and only one or two doctors and trainers who get disgusted and leave after a few hours. They have got 4 hours to get a press release ready for Brady Hoke's first press conference, the weekly one at the Young Center, and they don't get it done in time in 4 hours. So Brady Hoke's got to get up there with two instructions. One, whatever you do, don't talk about the Shane Morris situation. These are people who have no idea what they're doing, all right, from Dave Brandon on down about PR, because we have about 3 or 4 times the number of normal media there for that game. Trucks have come in from Chicago, from New York, from Al Jazeera, just kidding. We have about 3 or 4 times the normal number of media with one question. What the heck happened with Shane Morris? We don't care about the Rutgers game coming up, only Shane Morris. And throughout the interview, all right, press conference, Brady Hoke keeps on saying again and again and again, all right, I can't talk about that. He finally starts breaking down a bit and saying more than he should, and the message gets off a little bit, and it starts screwing things up a little bit. On top of that, the second instruction is keep on telling the press that as soon as you leave the podium, they're going to have press releases in their hands from the department explaining everything. All right, so he keeps on saying that, and his estimate is off by only 12 hours. The press release is not ready to go at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday. It comes out at 12:52 a.m. Tuesday morning. All right, and the reason for that is not because they're trying to be cute with it and wait till the cover of darkness to hide their sins or whatever else. That's how long it took them to write the one-page press release. You start at 8 o'clock in the morning. And Dave Brandon wanted this to go quickly, so he did not even feed anybody. So by 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they're getting food out of the vending machines, for crying out loud. This meeting lasts 17 hours. Anybody here who's been to a meeting, and I bet that's all of us, how many of your meetings got better after 2 hours? Multiply that times something. All right? Do you really think in hour 16, you know, hour 17, we're going to get this thing, absolutely. So the release goes out. It's a disaster. Obviously, the release itself is actually written pretty well, in my opinion, but it's still a disaster. Things blow up. There's a rally on campus the next day to get Dave Brandon fired, and things go downhill from there. So a month later, Dave Brandon resigns, calls up President Schlissel, and offers his resignation. He kind of has to at that point. And President Schlissel, who's been on the job for about 3 or 4 months, he accepts it. When he hangs up the phone, he calls a man named Jim Hackett, now well known to most of you, I believe, who's at his home in Spring Lake, near Grand Rapids. He's just retired as a 20-year CEO of Steelcase Furniture. And President Schlissel, at this point, has never even met Jim Hackett. They've talked on the phone once a month earlier, the week after the Shane Morris thing, to get some good advice, and they got a good feel for each other. It was a very good conversation. On that basis alone, President Schlissel made what I consider one of the all-time big-time leadership calls and offers Jim Hackett the position of interim AD. And Hackett says, I need to think about this and ask my wife. I've been married now 97 weeks, undefeated. That's a really good idea. And my wife, Christy, is here, of course, and has done a great job getting me to this point. So he asks his wife, what do you think, Kathy? And she says, if that's what you want to do, I'll support you. And the next question is that what you want to do? Hackett's still not sure. So he's going to call up a friend of his. He's an executive headhunter who gets CEOs for companies. One of his side jobs every 4 years is to fill the presidential cabinet. This is an almost impossible task because the guys you want for this job, for example, for Secretary of Treasury, you want Rubin, of course, who's a huge Wall Street CEO making $40 million a year, private jet, corner office, Central Park, all this stuff. And what are you offering? $250,000, right? A cramped office, a small staff, and every Sunday on TV, people you don't know are going to insult you publicly. What do you think? That's a very hard pitch. But he's a great closer, and he closes by saying this: some jobs are for God and country. And he says to Hackett, Jim, I've been talking to you for years about Michigan. I know that for you, this job is about God and country. And Hackett says, that is all I needed to hear. And he hangs up, has a two-word text message to President Schlissel: I'm in. That's it. No negotiation, no salary, no conditions, no terms, no anything. Just, if you need me, I will answer. I'm in. That's what it looks like when a business goes back to being a religion. It is not a rational choice. You don't do it for those reasons. Right? That's why you do this. So Hackett is in. All right. Now, here's the catch. He's got to make pretty much the same pitch to Jim Harbaugh. That might be a little harder. I don't know. So all last fall, we all heard endlessly on Twitter, on the reports, on TV, from some very sharp, some friends of mine, who are very good NFL reporters, no how and no way will Jim Harbaugh ever return to the University of Michigan. He's going to stay in the NFL always. And I already knew, I did not know if Jim Harbaugh was going to come to Michigan. I already knew that that line of reasoning was ridiculous. I can prove it several ways. One, I've known Jim since we're in fourth grade. I played baseball against him. I played hockey with him. We were line mates back in 1978 for Wilkinson Luggage. Just doing that's enough for a laugh, isn't it? I can barely reach over this podium and see the problem here already. One of us was a great athlete, by the way. I won't tell you who until you buy the book. I really was not planning on insulting myself so much tonight, but that's how it works sometimes. So I've known Jim for a long time. We're not best buddies. I don't want to overstate it. But he calls us trusted friends and known agents, basically. Our known friends and trusted agents. And I guess I'm in that category. So on July 18th of 2014, Jim Harbaugh is in town for one of his Michigan State players who played for the 49ers. He's getting married in Leelanau County. So he comes out the day earlier to go to a friend of his place, Todd Anson's, on Lake Charlevoix. And yes, I do know the geography of this. Of course, we're all hanging out together on one of these float boats in Lake Charlevoix, having a few beers, talking about old times and so on. And at this point, Brady Hoke is supposed to go 9-3 that year, 2014. Jim Harbaugh is supposed to go back to the NFC Conference title game for the fourth straight year. The job is not available. Jim Harbaugh is not a candidate. But there we are, having a few beers with this boat from Dr. Boyke, with the Michigan flag flying off the back. And sure enough, out of nowhere comes another boat with a Michigan State flag flying off the back. And before you know it, our boat is jamming the Victors, of course. Michigan State's boat is jamming their fight song, going back and forth. And Jim Harbaugh, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we start racing down the lake. I don't know why. It kind of all made sense at the time. I'm not sure. You guys have all been on boats. You know what I'm talking about. So Jim Harbaugh stands up, and as we're flying down the lake, he starts leading our boat into a rousing rendition of Hail to the Victors, and that eventually drowns out the other boat, who moons us on the way out, by the way. And that's in the book, by the way. So Jim Harbaugh sits down, and he slaps his knee and says, man, that never happens in the NFL. And I'm thinking about that, I think he's probably right. You know, in San Francisco Bay, they don't have like the Raiders boat and the Niners boat. They don't have fight songs for starters also, it wouldn't work. Then he turns to Sarah and says, Sarah, you have to learn this song. And that's where it starts sinking in that this guy has not left Ann Arbor, nor the University of Michigan. It's still very much in his heart. Later on that night, it's around 2:00 in the morning, we're having a few beers. Jim did not actually drink. I think he's drinking milk, believe it or not. So there's that story again. at that point, but I was having a few beers anyway, so we're just talking about old times, mutual friends and all this business, Michigan football, and he cuts me off in the middle, and he says, man, wasn't it great growing up in a college town? And I think, yes, it was. Why do you ask, man with young children? He didn't answer me then, but he didn't answer me a few months later. So I knew it was on his mind, and one of the favorite parts of the book for me is how the grassroots effort of the students, the lettermen who call Jim every Saturday, including a 43-year-old dishwasher at Pizza House who got Tom Brady in touch with Jim Harbaugh pretty incredibly. They're hammering Jim's phone. Jim Hackett is talking to him every Saturday in December. Finally, on Saturday, December 27th, the day before Jim Harbaugh's last game with the 49ers, it's very clear he's going to leave at that point. Jim Hackett calls up Harbaugh for the last time. He says, Jim, we've gotten along very well. You know what I'm talking about. I need to know from you now. Today is my walkaway date. This is it for me. Do you want to be the next head football coach at the University of Michigan? And Harbaugh says, you know, I'm still under contract, and I will be through tomorrow night, and I will not violate my contract. And Hackett says, I understand that. I respect that. That's part of integrity that I appreciate about you. I need your word. Do you want to be the next head football coach at the University of Michigan? And Hackett said, he paused, and he paused, and he paused, and he finally said, I'm in. That's it. So Hackett tells me later on, he said, you know, in business, there was no way in hell I would ever have my most important post rely on a phone call on a Saturday night with no witnesses, nothing written down, no text, no faxes, no anything, all right? But I knew I could trust Jim Harbaugh. I played for Bo. He played for Bo. We were raised in the same system. We're both Michigan men. That mattered to both of us. I knew his word was good. And the next day, Hackett has got the opportunity to receive the same favor from the Harbaugh camp of trust. That morning, Jim is in L.A. visiting his son and his grandkids. He's going to fly home, and John Denniston, who is Harbaugh's attorney and also kind of his agent, who's also a Michigan Law School graduate, which will prove very important, by the way, very shortly, all he's got to do is write a one-page term sheet. All that is, legally, is an agreement to agree down the road, that basically we agree to each other to do a contract next week. So all Jim Hackett's got to do is sign that thing and hit send, and that's it. So he's going to do it on his iPad on the long flight home from L.A. to Detroit. On the flight home, he discovers the internet on the plane doesn't work. So now you got 4.5 hours where you not only cannot fulfill your promise, you can't even tell him why you can't fulfill your promise. All right? There's no communication whatsoever. There's radio silence. When he gets to Detroit Metro Airport, he runs to the Westin Hotel and bursts in through their business center, only to discover that the business center at the Westin Hotel can't handle PDF files. You are now 0-2, and now it's 5 hours. He says, okay, Hackett, think, Jim, think. Okay, I'll take a photograph of my signature on this thing with my cell phone. I'll hit send. That should do it for now. Looks down at his cell phone, and of course, he did not hit airplane mode during his flight. His cell phone is dead. Now you're 0-3 based on, you know, technical incompetence, more or less. Jim's a good guy and a smart guy, but there he was. So he is in a panic to find a socket for his cell phone, and he finds one at the bar of the Westin Hotel. So he plugs in there and gets a beer, because what the hell? Why not at that point? And down at the end of the bar are two guys watching the game, which happens to be the 49ers. And Jim Harbaugh is kicking butt in the first half of the game. And they look down there and they see Jim Hackett. He's been on the job for about a month, but in the paper a fair amount. They look down the bar and said, hey, you're Jim Hackett, aren't you? And Hackett told me, for a second there, I thought about lying. Things aren't going that well. No, I'm not Hackett. Why would I be Jim Hackett? Just plugging my phone over here is all I'm doing. Doctor's orders. So he says, yeah, I'm Jim Hackett. He said, oh, look at this. Harbaugh's kicking butt. You must be thrilled. He's going, yeah. He's seen his dream candidate slip through his fingers because he can't get his cell phone plugged in on time. Finally, he gets it plugged in, and he takes a photograph of his signature, hits send. John Denniston receives that on his cell phone in the locker room of the 49ers during the halftime of Harbaugh's last game. And John Denniston and I have become good friends in this process as well, and he told me the same thing Hackett told me. It was the Oakland Raiders, the Chicago Bears, or the New York Jets, there's no way in hell I wait 6 hours on an offer. It's your last day. Your word's no good. We're on to the next guy after 1 hour. We're out. But Hackett's a Michigan guy. I'm a Michigan guy. I knew I could trust him. I waited. I got it. That was it. So 3 months later, I'm talking to Jim Harbaugh in his office at Michigan. I said, okay, you know, why'd you come back to Michigan? Because I was hearing that from the Bears, the Jets, the Raiders, it's all talk until you see a contract. But I was hearing things like $10 million as the opening bid from those three teams. He's the hottest coach in America at that time. And, of course, get three NFL owners in a room with their egos, and all of a sudden $10 million becomes 11 or 12 very quickly. And I said, you know, why'd you come to Michigan? And he says, well, don't put me on the same dance floor as Mother Teresa. I am making $7 million. Okay, it's not exactly a vow of poverty, I'll grant you that. But, you know, NFL would have paid you more. And he says, I can say I did not come to Michigan because I thought Michigan would pay me the most. I said, why did you come to Michigan? He says, 3 days earlier, I was talking to my dad, Jack Harbaugh, who had coached for Bo in the 70s. I said, Dad, you know what I know. What do you think? He says, son, you've always made good decisions. My advice is to follow your heart. And Harbaugh looks at me and says, so that's what I did. And that's it. That is why Jim Harbaugh is the coach at Michigan. I'll close with the last page of the book. I hate to ruin the ending for you, but it does have a happy ending, I promise. And it goes like this. It would be a mistake to reduce this story to a simple saga of Dave Brennan leaving and Jim Harbaugh arriving. It was much bigger than two men, and it went much deeper. After more than a century of sound stewardship, Michigan had lost its way. It had ignored established safeguards and forgot the values that had made it great in the first place. The resulting downfall was swift and stunning. But if Michigan's wounds were of its own hand, so were its remedies. Bit by bit, level by level, the people who had understood the values the program was built on in the first place stood up and fought back. The employees who cared more about Michigan than money, the lettermen who were more attached to their alma mater than any pro team, the students who came to Michigan anticipating a thriving community and insisted that it be rebuilt, the regents who listened and took action, and the new athletic director and the new head football coach who both returned to the place they loved most for less money. Tradition reached from the past, from Baird and Yost, Chrysler, Canham, and Schembechler, to a new generation of leaders, and they answered the call. Michigan was not broken for over a century, but when it finally cracked from the inside out, the people who knew its history rose to fix it and restore the meaning of a simple, timeless saying, "This is Michigan." Thank you.
That was John U. Bacon talking at the City Opera House in Traverse City. Bacon's latest book is End Zone: The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.